Welcome to today's episode of Conversations About Running, the podcast from Running Trips. Running Trips are the company behind Kenya Experience and our brand new training focus camps, UK training weekends for competitive runners of all levels. Today's guest is James T. James is a running coach based in Cardiff, where he's also a lecturer and athletics director at Cardiff Met University. James is a former professional runner and sub 4 minute miler, who finished fourth in the IAAF World Indoor Championships in 2004. In today's episode, we talk to James about his background in athletics, the challenges of coaching elite runners through the COVID pandemic, Jake Smith, the marathon maverick, and then recall a tale from James's own running career to which the phrase maverick also surely applies. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy this episode of Conversations About Running with Coach James T.
Hey Callum, you well?
Yeah, I'm all good, thanks mate. Yeah, enjoying a rest day.
That's a rare occasion for you, isn't it, to get a complete rest?
Yeah, Hugo is pretty big on the mileage, and he's always, even on an easy day, it's usually two easy runs. So a full rest day, yeah, I don't know what to do with myself.
What do you do, James, with rest days for your guys? Do you have complete rests, or is it more of a...
Yeah, every 2 weeks, I kind of like most of the guys on bigger mileage take a whole day off. Some of the mid distance guys, some of them run a rest day once a week. So, but yeah, and some can't. Well, they struggle to have a whole day off, so they might do a little bit of cross training, but not a double day of running anyway.
Is that when you say they struggle to have a full day off? I get visions of myself here. Is that sort of more of a mental barrier? Like, oh, I can't rest. I've got to do something.
Yeah, for some it's just they just struggle, and can I do some yoga or S&C or so. I water it down a bit, but I think some of them get the understanding that if you're training hard, one whole day off in a 2 week cycle is you need it to a certain degree anyway.
I think some people just, there's a little bit of something going on. People have almost turned it into something a bit scary to have a day off, because you say like, oh, it's only one day off in so many days or whatever, but I've heard it said so many times, like if you have a day off every week, you're missing a month and a half of training in a year.
Yeah, but then you look at Legat. Bernard Legat's a great example, that he used to take 3 months off or 2 months off after a track season, and he raced till he was 43. So you could argue it buys you time on the old on the mileage clock. So I think the other thing is, you absorb your good work when you're resting. I tend to give the guys that are on big mileage, they tend to be Friday session. And actually that Friday session is probably the hardest one in the 2 week cycle. And actually I kind of want them looking forward to actually like having a day off on a Saturday where they can go and do something different and, and actually kind of maybe spend some time with whoever they're spending time with. Because, most weeks at some point you're away racing or training on weekends. So yeah, I think to a point they hopefully enjoy having a day off sometimes.
Yeah, no, I can see that.
And then you're back on a Sunday run on the Sunday, putting some big miles in. So it's kind of like, well,
yeah, you just kind of reset your motivation for 24 hours and be back to
exactly.
So, James, we've jumped straight into a running related topic there. We didn't really even get going with an introduction. Thanks for coming on the podcast with us.
Pleasure.
So for anyone listening, then today's guest, as you heard in our introduction, is Coach James T. James, can you maybe start us off with a little bit of a general background on yourself? Kind of maybe assume someone's never heard, like someone doesn't know who you are. Sort of give us just a brief intro to who you are, what you do, and sort of what your involvement in the sport is.
Yeah, so I mean, as a runner, and I still am just about a runner in some regards. So I've been running 33 years. Came through the school system, came through the club system. The kind of usual kind of British existence in terms of road relays, cross countries. I was at an English school, so I did things like English schools and kind of got to a decent level where at university I took it a lot more seriously. I went to Cardiff Met, where I kind of never left really, and kind of ended up being a professional athlete for a few years. And then loving the sport so much, I kind of gravitated into working for Reebok and then working for Welsh Athletics. And now in the current role I'm in at the moment, where I'm a university lecturer and also director of athletics at Cardiff Met, hence the reason why I never left. Also doing my doctorate alongside that. I've got a young family, and I've also dabbled in the old Masters championships as well. And you know, at 43, still kind of enjoying my running. So, but it's kind of the coaching element that's really kind of taken my kind of you know, inspiration and time over the last 10 years. So I kind of got involved with coaching off the back end of my kind of first career. Just, you know, some athletes kind of approached me and asked if I could help them, and then it obviously became a little bit more formal through the university. And now I have a group of university students, alumni, people that come and train with us, people that are local, people that are international, and people that that, you know, are remotely kind of coached by myself. So yeah, predominantly in terms of athletics now, a coach more than anything else.
Yeah, good man. I just want to quickly pick up on two things you mentioned there. First of all, what are you working on your doctorate towards? I don't know if that's the correct terminology for it. What will your doctorate be in that you're working?
Yeah, so doctorate, it's a good way of doing it when you're a busy person. I'm doing a talk doctorate, so I'm kind of two thirds down, which has taken me about 4 years. I'm now into my final thesis, which is a 30,000 word thesis. It's in sports coaching, so. It's been fascinating kind of putting theory to practice, talking with other coaches from all walks of life. And now I'm, you know, I've got a lot of reading and writing to go in the final project. But my final project's about the emotions of coaching, which is kind of unspoken about sometimes. Like, you know, when you do education or you talk about coaching, it's always about planning. It's always quite structured. Whereas actually you're dealing with people, and there's a huge amount of emotions, whether that's the athlete, there's a huge amount of emotions, whether that's the coach, and almost how that kind of, you know, that multifaceted world of life, coaching, results and everything that go around. So what that kind of looks like. So my aim is to get a little bit of discussion around emotions of coaches and in coaching.
Okay. So is that kind of emotions overlapping with sort of the psychology side?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of the whole kind of premise for almost, you know, the has almost said it's not really spoken about so much. You know, we kind of see coaches and we kind of see the environment of sport, and often, you know, athletes' emotions are talked about, you know, in terms of you know, psychology support and, you know, kind of understanding, but actually the emotions that coaches go through isn't really tapped into, isn't really written as much as it should be or could be. And as I said, it's more just to open the eyes to coaches that the feelings that you have to certain situations and you know, the environment that you're in, that hopefully there's a bit of normality to it, but it also helps you kind of process it and understand it a bit more. Because, you know, you're dealing with people's hopes and dreams. You're looking after people, you know, that have more than just athletics issues going on. And ultimately you're the person that kind of charges, you know, pastoral care, you know, and their almost emotional care is in your hands. So it's maybe a bit of a give back to the coaching community to get that discussion out there.
I think that's really important work. Do you feel that that's having an impact on yourself as a coach as you go through that process?
Oh, it definitely has. I mean, you know, learning, you know, every coach will say, or they should do, that you're always learning. I mean, you know, you don't do the same thing year on year. You don't act the same year on year. You kind of learn. So having it a bit, you know, structured through the talk doctorate, it's been great for going through the different modules and breaking it down, a lot of reflection, listening to other coaches. And then also seeing that there is a theory side to most of what we do. Often we think that, you know, the way we act or what we say is kind of our own kind of you know, manifested or kind of, you know, individual world, but actually when you get into it, there's reasons and rationales and theories why, and that's been fascinating. So but like anything, you're looking at areas that are maybe underrepresented. I think that I'm in a lucky position, being obviously, you know, I'd like to think, you know, obviously an elite coach looking after elite athletes in an elite environment,
but also having the academic opportunity is rare as well, and maybe the time or the opportunity to actually write, because often that just doesn't happen in that environment. You're either one or the other, so it's kind of trying to merge the two. And it is, you know, there's obviously a lot of work that goes into it. But as I said, if it ends up helping coaches, you know, even if it ends up helping one coach kind of figure out a bit more that it's okay, or things are, you know, this is normal to feel like this, or there's ways of kind of dealing with it or processing it, then hopefully that could be beneficial to the kind of field and national governing bodies, or the kind of coach education structure that, again, is, as I said, it's very much about planning. It's very much about how the athlete feels, as opposed to how the coach feels.
So is this field of study got anything to do then with the governing body, or is it just something that you feel might overlap at some point in the future?
It doesn't at the moment. I mean, I'm quite lucky. I'm part of the British Milers Club now, which is obviously, you know, a big institution in distance running in the UK. I'm on the coaching panel there, with the ability to present when I need to. I like to think if anything comes out, you know, I'm obviously, you know, part of Welsh Athletics setup as well. So I think NGBs are very open now, and there's very much a, you know, very much, you know, a better culture of sharing and understanding. But I still think that there's, you know, the conversations I've had with coaches informally over the last, even with the pandemic, over the last 18 months about, you know, how we're feeling about coaching during a pandemic, or, you know, what to do. I mean, because no one knew how to coach during a pandemic. It wasn't in any handbook. But actually, you make sense to talking to other coaches, and you make sense of the mistakes you've made, or the kind of uncertainty and the disappointments. And the I still feel it now. I think every person probably in their day-to-day lives is feeling a little bit kind of uncertain about, you know, what their future might be, what the kind of outlook might be on their own running. And, you know, what that might look like in 12 months' time. So if you put it under the lens of coaching, you know, where you're trying to get people to perform to their very best, then yeah, it becomes even more kind of heightened. So, yeah, I think the last 18 months has brought out probably even more so into prominence, just because, yeah, I think everyone's emotions over the last 18 months have been absolutely you know, intensified, and I think we're all feeling slightly emotionally toast. So, you know, so get the discussions out there in every walk of life, and my vehicle being coaching.
Yeah, no, I love it. That's great.
We've spoken quite a lot about in previous podcasts, myself and Gavin, and our coach who is the head coach for the Kenya Experience Camps, Hugo. We've spoken a lot about how running has changed over the pandemic, and how athletes have changed their training and changed their goals as a result of the pandemic. But could you give us a little bit of insight on how coaching has changed, like how your interaction with your athletes? I mean, you touched on it then, the kind of emotional side, but yeah, over the last sort of 12 months or so, how have you found that the pandemic affected the coaching?
It's a really good question. I'm sure every runner of any level could kind of identify. It was obviously, you know, the original lockdown was just, you know, pure uncertainty. But for the athletes I was looking after, I kept structure in their kind of training, because I wanted them to have a little bit of a goal each day when we had the one exercise token a day. But they had some structure to it. So I let some push different parameters and have a little bit more say in what they wanted to do, because I wanted them to enjoy. So there was quite a lot of empowerment in what they wanted to do. And kind of, I was more than happy with that. You know, different people had different facilities, whether it was home gyms, whether it was, you know, exercise bikes, whether it was, you know, grass tracks. And obviously the you know, I coach, you know, to make people run faster in races. And that was probably the hardest thing, where, you know, everything had been so structured, you know, whether it was an indoors to a cross country to road to track. And any level, you know, I look after all levels of athletes, and whether they're looking to run their first ever half marathon or get a park run personal best, that was the hardest thing, where suddenly all these goals that we had, and all these kind of structured kind of landmarks were suddenly gone. And so obviously we reinvented it with some kind of time trials. Some didn't do time trials, some did. But I think that, you know, talking to them, I had very, very little drop off in the athletes I look after, almost none, which I was blown away by, because I would have thought at that point, if you were struggling, that that would have been, you know, a time to pull away. But actually almost the opposite. I had such good engagement. And then I think everyone found it hard then the second time, when the second lockdown came, because we all thought it was going to get better. People had done these great blocks of training, and then we hoped it was going to go into a proper winter, and then it didn't happen. And that was, again, real tough emotionally as a coach, because you're the one trying to pick people up all the time. And you're almost like absorbing everyone's kind of negative.
Was there an increase then in not dependency, but was there an increase in athletes kind of reliance on you as a coach through that period?
Oh yeah, because, you know, normally we'd have, and that was probably the, other than races, probably one thing that probably was even harder, with the fact that we couldn't have group sessions, and people thrive off that in terms of, you know, meeting and interacting, and even a bad session in a group where there's a bit of, you know, discussion on the warm up and cool down is better than a bad session on your own. It's just lonesome. And that was probably the toughest thing. I think athletes, you know, obviously, you know, the feedback I was getting was obviously all individual. The feedback I was getting was obviously sometimes, you know, very electronic, whether it was heart rates, paces. And emotionally wise, that's hard to coach, because I tend to coach when I'm watching people on what I'm seeing and what I'm kind of getting feedback from them, even whether it's during a rep or during a, you know, during a run, or the information that you can kind of gather from just watching people. But when that gets taken away, obviously then you have to, you know, dig deeper for it. And there's a lot more kind of time consuming conversations, which I loved, and it helped the athletes, but it's still a cumulative to, obviously during a pandemic as well. So it wasn't even as if it was, you know, a normal situation, as in just intensified. I think the disappointments of going back into lockdown, races being cancelled, not being able to get on tracks, elite only was another sticking point of, you know, the kind of, I don't know, just this group mentality suddenly going out the window, that some could train on some facilities, some couldn't, some could race, some couldn't. And again, when you said you thrive off the interaction, and that gets taken away, you thrive off competition, that gets taken away. Emotionally, I sent to another coach, we're having a chat on, I think it was Tuesday or Monday, but it kind of feels already like it's August now, mentally, and it's only June, because there's so many hurdles and so many, you know, bits of work gone in just to get to June, that it feels like a long, long season already. So, I just don't think anything timelines or feelings or emotions are normal right now.
So something you mentioned there just made me think back to my own days as a coach, which are long in the past now. Are you a coach who then thrives on kind of the visual of being around the athletes, seeing the athletes, and kind of gaining information from the athletes without actually being told what it's told by the athlete themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I do for a majority, because obviously, you know, I do have athletes that I don't see on a day-to-day basis. And so there is a bit more, you know, kind of, you know, to it. I think when you've got a group situation, you know, for a majority, that does help with that aspect of it, because, you know, you get the interaction. Sometimes I've got sessions that, you know, because there are certain sessions that are, you know, kind of, you know, lifebloods of your philosophy. And so you might have your group doing the session, but you might also have someone remotely doing the same session. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can kind of feel or get a feel for the cycle, or how hard it was, or what they were looking at, or how they were looking. And so then you can kind of get a bit more information then, or kind of, you know, interact with the athlete that's remotely being coached as well. So, but I think when it's all, everyone was individual, and everyone was, you know, it was tough for them also just to kind of stay motivated about, you know, potential goals. Or, but as I said, I mean, that was the other thing, was I was blown away by the fact that they wanted the structure, mm-hmm. And they wanted help and support. And I think that it gave, hopefully, them a bit of an escapism, you know, whereas they could go out and they knew what they needed to do run wise. There wasn't uncertainty. As I said, we mixed it up with some fun things. We did something called the Cooper test 1 week, where it's about 12 minutes as fast as you can.
It's funny you brought that up, because I'm fairly certain that on my session on Tuesday, the only people out on Brockington at Loughborough at that particular time was myself and a couple of footballers. And I'm pretty sure they were doing the Cooper test. Because I saw them mark out some cones like inside the line that I was using, and they were taking it pretty seriously. And I thought they must be doing some sort of minute reps or something when they got started. And they did not pace themselves well for 12 minutes at all.
What is the Cooper test?
So for people that don't know it, Callum, so basically you run 12 minutes. And it actually goes on the distance. So there is a chart, but it's a little bit outdated. So I would more use it as a bit of a fitness guide that you might go and revisit it. So again, it might be a good one for a 5K runner, part run runner, because that pace probably that you run for 12 minutes, obviously, elite and beyond are going to be getting 4K. You know, obviously some runners might be 3K if you're a 20 minute park runner.
Joshua Chapter guy might just finish
I might be 200 meters away from finishing. Okay. But what it does give is it gives you a bit of a marker where, we often get caught up with, you're running against a set distance, whereas this is you're running against the clock. I gave it to athletes as almost it was something that I knew they'd never done before. I asked them to pick a course that they could go and replicate it in a few weeks' time. That also had the potential maybe to bolt on another kilometer, few minutes running after. And actually people attacked it and people really enjoyed it. And it was a nice, and we did it in a bit of a league table. I put it into like a handicap system. So depending on your ability and your age and your gender, you got different kind of seconds added or taken away. And it was a good way of kind of the group being competitive, even though everyone did it remotely, that they could actually be kind of competitive. And we did a few things like that where we did a relay where everyone ran 4 miles and they were in a relay team. But they were in relay teams across the world, across the UK, across Wales. But they all had their own little team and it was for charity. So we raised a bit of money for charity. So I think if we go into another lockdown, it's just how creative can you be? I think people were very creative first time around. Just to keep that motivation. There's always some people that don't like time trials and they hate things like.
Did it add a lot of fun in sort of the group chats afterwards as well, of sort of people saying, "Oh, your watch doesn't measure the same as mine."
Yeah, and I always said to people also, and there's always a bit of banter about different loops and social media about people getting records on segments. And actually, my argument with people that were critical of it is that people needed something to be motivated about.
Yeah.
And you know what? If it showed a little bit faster than you might have ran, that you need that sometimes. Because if you're not going to go out, let's be honest, you're not going to go out into an industrial estate and run the fastest 3K of your absolute life, potentially, in layman terms. But you probably should go back and on a track in a few weeks, months later and run much faster, or you should have anyway. But if you did and that motivated you to stay training for the next few weeks, months, then what's wrong with that really? You're not taking it away from anyone else. You weren't beating anyone else on that industrial estate.
So I think where Callum and I have taken issue with that kind of thing previously has been more where people have used it to try and not beat other people down, but have tried to use it as, look how great I am, I ran this, and they haven't been able to replicate it in a race situation.
Yes, that's true.
Then you think, come on.
That's true. But then if it helped them stay motivated.
Yeah, true.
And they, there were no real prizes. Oh, I suppose there were some prizes. Okay, I think if someone cheated, there was I think one case, no names, of I think it was mechanical
GPS manipulation.
Strava GPS, cheating. So, I mean, if you're running on a loop you normally run and it's generous to you, then that's inevitably going to happen. There's no consistency. So, but I've had athletes that have run super, super fast. But since then, they've gone on the track and they've run faster, way faster for 5K. So even though some people were calling them up on what they did. So actually, but I know that what they did, if they hadn't have done that and they hadn't been motivated to have gone down in industrial state and run hard, then actually they wouldn't have raced mentally for 18 months and they probably wouldn't be where they are now. So I think it served a purpose. I think it wasn't for everyone. But yeah, it made it interesting, and also it got us all talking and interested and searching other people's Stravas and measuring loops with Matt Cavrano. So we all did it. We all got interested. That's what we love. That's why you all go on Parrot 10 and see results. Is we love looking at results and info. So
do you remember, James? I think we're sort of close enough in age terms to remember long before Power of 10, when it used to be you had to wait for Athletics Weekly to come through your door on a Wednesday morning.
See, I missed that. I used to love. We used to have our big training session of the night on a Tuesday, and I remember I always used to think, even during the last rep or even during cool down, I couldn't wait for Athletics Weekly in the morning. And I'd be first down at the newsagents to get it in the morning. I'd have read half of it by the time walking back up the hill. And then just memorizing and get the pad and paper out and writing the under 17 3K ranking list based off the last few weeks of Athletics Weekly and the McDonald's League. And I kind of, and people laugh now, but, you know, obviously I do quite a lot of commentary and kind of, announcing at events. And I have to say, look, for the first part of that career as an announcer, all those years of reading Athletics Weekly and all those ridiculous stats that I don't know my family's birthdays. I honestly get my family's birthdays, but I can tell you what Barry Royden for Medway ran
in 5K
on the track in September in Kent. I don't know why I can remember that. I probably remember Paul Evans's training schedule for the Chicago Marathon that they printed. But if you ask me, you know, my nephew's birthday, I'm don't know that. So it's amazing. you can recall and it captured my imagination. So I kind of feel a bit bad or a bit sad that kids don't have that magic that we had.
It's so readily available that it's great that it's readily available, but it's watered down to an extent.
Yeah, and also like just getting your picture in there or getting your result in there first. You know, that was wow. You know, my name's actually in print. And then maybe getting a mention. That was the other thing is like, you know, and then when I got my first picture in there.
Have you had a front cover?
Do you know what? That's how sad my life is. I was thinking about that the other day, that was one of the things. I almost had it one year. And Joe Fenn, brilliant 800 meter runner, smashed out the British champs. And she broke the championship record, I think. And I think that was my one issue where I think I was potentially front cover material, and it didn't happen. So it wasn't to be. So, and I think the fact it's monthly now is that's gone.
I've had one photo where I've been name checked, where it's specifically a photo of me. And then a couple where it's been, if you know where to look, I could point myself out. It's the inter-counties. It's a photo of like Vernon and Ryan McLeod I can't think who else was up there, but of those kind of runners. And if you squint your eyes, you can see the third or fourth Hampshire vest back in the 30s or 40s. It's me. But yeah,
Kids was asking me about something, I don't know, 2 days ago. And actually, I don't know why it got into a conversation or something, but I was actually featured on Grandstand, used to have an athletics program. And I think it was 2004, 2005. So they profiled an athlete each week. And I actually had my profile at, I think, midday on Grandstand on a Saturday. So I didn't make Athletics Weekly, but I did make the Grandstand athletics
program. Yeah, that's not bad.
Claim to fame, that one. And I think the funny thing was, I think it was Steve Cram got thrown under the bus by Roger Black after, because he said, oh, so is James C the next big Middle Eastern star? And Cram, he was like, no, I don't think so. So it was a nice come down, but all is good. All is good.
I think it does still feel like a big deal if you get a photo or something in Athletics Weekly. I've had one and that was like fairly recently, and it felt like, you know, it felt like a big deal that I could see my photo in print.
I think it's more for me, it's more the results are so readily available in the rankings are so readily available. They used to print each week at the end of the season. They'd go through, I can't remember the order, but a different age group. So it'd be the under 13 girls would get their rankings, and the next week the under 13 boys would get their rankings, and you're just waiting for the under 17 boys and thinking, have I made the rankings? Top 15 or top 20? And you open it, and you're like, and then you try and you think it went down to 855, and I ran 857, and you know, last year the rankings went to 903. I would have made it if it was last year.
Yeah.
Kind of the way I think about it is, what I would relate it to is, say for instance, if you watch basketball, it's still good to score, but points just come so readily; they're not that exciting. Whereas in football, you score a goal, it doesn't happen that often. So the emotion is much higher.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. I think one of the things that obviously has changed, massively is obviously, social media now. So, and I think that is one of the differences. Our kudos might have been our names or, a little picture in Athletics Weekly, whereas now a performance. But obviously, anyone can post anything, can't they, nowadays, and jazz it up. So, but I think good performances do get maybe a little bit more recognition, obviously, worldwide. The thing that's blown me away is, how training sessions can get kudos and get, we'll probably end up talking about soon at some point. But that's the thing that probably never happened. If your training got printed somewhere or a session got printed, it was as of, previous, year or 2 years. Whereas now it's almost instant. Something goes on there and it can go viral.
Yeah. Well, I think we know which example we're talking about at the moment. So go on.
They get thrown around in our WhatsApp group daily. Jake Smith's training.
So for anyone who's not listening, doesn't know immediately what we're talking about. So Jake Smith, one of James's athletes, correct me if I get anything wrong here, James, along the way. But so he's run 60:23, I want to say, for half marathon.
60:31
for a half marathon.
Yeah.
And how old is Jake?
22. We're 23 now. Yeah.
Okay, 23. So a young athlete performing at an exceptional level. One of his training sessions just recently, what do you call it? A fartlek on the track, would you call it?
In and outs.
Sort of K on, K off on the track. And Jake uploaded it to Strava, instantly it seemed it was all over the internet, just so many people commenting on it, reposting it. I'm really interested in your perspective on this, James, because for me personally, that wouldn't be a good thing. Like, that would have a negative impact on my training, or not necessarily on my training, but on my psyche. Like, because to me, rather than being exciting, everyone's talking about how great I am and everyone wants to talk about my training, to me, that would add a heap load of pressure on me.
Yeah. I think that it's every athlete is slightly different. And, athletes, crave some attention sometimes. Some like, to disappear to back and beyond and just get on with it. There's an honesty there in terms of, showing it to people. Obviously there's an honesty that, for the result that we were after, to obviously qualify for the Olympic 10,000, it didn't happen. But then, it's interesting that, the feedback and the interest and actually, so many nice comments about people saying it really motivates you to say, Callum, that people talk about it in chats, and actually kind of, gets people talking about, what people are doing. So you talk about, adding interest or adding kind of discussion and kind of excitement to our sport. It craves that. Mm. I think you're right. I think the psychology of it's really interesting. If to some athletes that would blow the minds putting it out there, you do put yourself out a little bit vulnerable that if you do run a session like that, that is almost phenomenal. And in hindsight and, reflection wise, it's all about the result at the end of the day. And so, and that we were quite honest, and I was honest to Jake after that, it's a good session, but it's not a great session unless we race well off it. So, the honesty of knowing that we did that. But then, when you're trying to shoot for something you've never hit before, so technically we're trying to run a performance by 30 seconds over 10K that he's never done before. So you have to be bold, and you can't do the same thing and expect different results. But the other thing is, we've done this session previously. So this wasn't something we hadn't done. And when he did it the time before, he comes to, he basically runs the 10 miles and he ran 47.04. And so the challenge was that, you know, I said to him, you know, can we run 15, 20 seconds faster as the challenge? The problem is he probably nailed the first part too well because he went through halfway for 5 miles in 23.05, which we all know at that level, at any level, it's going to bite you. But at elite level, you're talking such small margins. And that's actually what happened at the trials, where a couple of laps were just a bit too fast. He was ahead of the green lights that were set as 27.20. And actually, that's just too much right now. Sure. And the problem is once the body kicks back on you and you see your dream running away, the emotions all suddenly, and we haven't even mentioned the fact he ran a marathon 6 weeks ago in Olympic qualifying time with no drinks in his debut, pacing along. And I do think, and I all of us that have run marathons or train marathon runners, that there's certain rules and parameters that you've got to stick to. And that even if you think you're a freak of nature, you might get away with it. You might just ride the crest of a wave. And that's what we were trying to do into the trials, 10K trials. And actually, how he's feeling now is how he should have felt after the marathon. But it's almost a delayed impact of everything. But do you know what? You know, I think you got to shoot for it. And sometimes it pays off and other times it doesn't, you know.
So do you think he was almost riding, like you say, a crest of a wave after the marathon? Was he almost the motivation was so high coming off that he almost didn't realise how tired he was, and that didn't come out until a few weeks later?
I think that, going back to the emotional side of things, I think you should never underestimate the emotional investment, and also kind of, you know, the you know, what you're ultimately trying to achieve. And if that doesn't happen, then we all know when you have a good run, you probably seen it with the two women that just broke the 10,000 meter world record. They finish it and they look like they could run another 2 kilometers at that. You know, they could have jogged around and they're just bouncing along. We all know when you don't have a great run and you finish that 10K, you're on the floor.
Yeah.
There's nothing more to give. But a lot of that's just emotional, and it's a lot about the body kind of releasing itself from that state. And I mean, Jake's obviously still young and still developing, and obviously, you know, we didn't get the training right because he didn't end up running the time. How much he's down to running the marathon that was a bit impromptu and not planned, you know, some of it will be, some of it won't be. That's the thing as a coach, you have to take it on the chin that, you know, you got some things wrong. Other things we got right, because I still don't think you could run the session he did. And you guys know running as well as anyone. You can't run that type of session unless you're in shape.
Sure.
Whether you leave it in the session or whether you don't quite get it right is another thing. But it's, as I said, when you're trying to do something exceptional, you know, if Joshua Cheptegei was to put all his training on Strava, it would be exceptional. But that's because the guys... a freak of nature who runs exceptional times on the track. So I think it's an interesting discussion that we probably won't get to the bottom of, but
what were your thoughts on Jake finishing the marathon? Were you obviously he'd run an Olympic qualifying time, so that's amazing, but at the same time, as you said, it wasn't part of the plan. So what was your reaction?
When you've got someone like Jake who is a free marathon spirit maverick. When he's running marathon maverick, a little bit of a free spirit.
I wanted to buy one of those t-shirts.
They're still available.
You said so. Basically, how Lauren and I are handling this sort of economic situation at the moment is just to not that we got a pact between us that look, we can just try and live our lives as normal as possible, but let's just limit any unnecessary purchase. And I love Jake. Like, I'm just a massive fan of his. But a Marathon Maverick t-shirt has unfortunately just fallen on the wrong side of sensible economic.
Right. When it comes back round again and you're in a different situation, they will still be there. So, yeah, I think, when you've got someone as raw as Jake and someone that is as fearless that, you know, I said to other people that I want to keep him this, you know, like this for as long as possible, because we're a long time kind of overthinkers and a long time worried about everyone else and how our body's going to feel. And, you know, if my coach sets me a time for a training session that is a British record, and then you're going to go and run 15 seconds inside it, but not panic and think, oh, I've blown this session up. That to me is a huge quality to have. So to run a marathon and to actually have that thought process and actually be able to do it is amazing. But at an elite level where if you're trying to make a 10,000 meter Olympic team, it's probably not the best thing to have done because we didn't make the team. So ultimately the goal of this summer was make the Olympic 10,000 meter team. We didn't do that. But what it has shown is I again, you know, had conversations with different people over the last few years where, you know, 2 years ago, I said Jake was a marathon talent that I didn't think I'd seen before, not just in my group, but in other athletes. And I thought in a couple of years, he was going to debut something very, very special. And some people believe me. I think when he ran the 60 half marathon, some people were like, yeah, I can see it a bit more now. After the marathon, I had calls and messages and emails saying, no, you're absolutely right. You know, he's, if you can do that off the training and no drinks in that environment, then you've got a marathon runner that probably could run 2.8, 2.7 now. So give him another, you know, 2-3 years of development. Who knows where that might put him in the marathon standings. So, and road for him, he's in control of the road or longer reps. This is a guy that 3 years ago or two, sorry, 3.5 years ago came to university and couldn't break 30 seconds for 200 meters, had a 15:30 5K personal best. So there are kind of parameters that we've been kind of, you know, edging down. He still ran a 5K PB, you know, in Gateshead in horrible weather. So, that was 3 weeks after the marathon. So again, you know, you're still, as much as we're disappointed, you know, have we progressed? Yes. Did we get the best result for a 10K that we could have? No. Have we learned a bit more about everything? Probably yes. Is he young with lots of time in the future to put things right? Absolutely. Paris is only 3 years away, but he might be in the marathon in Paris. Who knows?
I think that's a fantastic insight, because I think a lot of people could look at it in, as an outsider, you could look at it in a much more negative frame of mind, and you could say, oh well, the idea was to make the 10K and you didn't do it, don't take this the wrong way, but didn't even get close. But what I'm hearing now is more that yes, there's disappointment in the short term, but through what happened in that marathon and subsequently, you've learned quite a lot about the physical and the psychological attributes that Jake has that can help him go even further in the future. Would that be a fair assessment?
Absolutely bang on. Yeah, that's exactly where we're at.
So interestingly, when we talk about Jake as a marathon maverick is a word that comes to mind a little bit when I think of some of the things that I kind of remember you as an athlete for. I'm going to see if you can guess which one I'm talking about without queuing it up.
Is it when I flew back from New York overnight?
Exactly that, yeah. Well, I was telling Callum about this the other day and he didn't believe me. So we were on the phone and we went on Power of 10 and I was like, I'm sure it was the very next day and we were scrolling through Power of 10 until we found it.
That's partly why I can't be angry with Jake when he does certain things, because I did some things. Do you want me to give the synopsis of it?
Yeah, go on.
So, so being a professional athlete is fun, but it's also a bit of a conundrum where, you know, to make a team for a championships, you don't get any money for. And only, you know, if you get a medal or get a very high performance there, do you get support potentially. So, I did quite a lot of my races indoors abroad for my athletics club over there, which was New York Athletic Club. And, you know, there was a big event that used to be at Madison Square Garden called the Milrose Games. And it had a very famous mile called the Wanamaker Mile. And, you know, looking at the program before the season, it clashed with the British Trials for the World Championship. So I was, no, I won't be able to do that. And then the program came out and it was a Friday night. The mile, and I looked at flights and it was doable to get back, as in, I think it was racing Madison Square Garden at 9:30 at night. And then there was a flight from JFK at 11:00 at night. And I looked at the field and thought, actually, this field isn't the strongest of mile fields for a long time. So basically hatched a plan that I'd run in New York, jump in a yellow cab to the airport and then fly back to the UK, but fly back to London, fly then London to Manchester, and then my good wife drive me from Manchester to Sheffield. For the heats of the championships were meant to be at 6 o'clock on the Saturday. So I thought, do you know what? I don't have to run hard on the Saturday. But ultimately, I could make some really good money and pay the bills for the next 6 months if I run well on the Friday night. So race in Madison Square Garden. I finished second, almost winning it. Make enough money to pay the rent for a long, long time. Get interviewed by ESPN, I think it was, as I was leaving. Jumped in a cab, still in my athletics kit. Drove to the airport. Got quickly into a smart suit and tie because I was on my brother's BA ticket because he worked for BA at the time. And if you look smart and you talk the talk, you can sometimes back in the day get an upgrade. So I managed to get an upgrade into business class, showing them the medal that I got from the race. I did the cool down in the cafe, or you know, the little cafe departure lounge. I literally went and got changed again, hadn't cooled down, so probably highly illegal. I put my bag in the middle of this very, very quiet departure lounge and did laps around the chairs on the outside and did my 10-minute cool down. Went and freshened up, got onto the flight, and they're coming around because it's business class. You get offered champagne. So I thought it'd be rude not to have at least a couple of glasses to help me sleep. I think it was a steak sandwich as well, which I seem to remember sticks out of my mind. So I'm having champagne, a steak sandwich in business class, thinking, well, that's one part of the worry over. I'm actually on the flight. It seems like it's on time. So fly through the night, land the next day on Saturday morning, and then the flight again. I'm lucky it's no issues, no delays. So up to Manchester, and then my wife drive across, stunning drive across the Pennines, and I'm looking at the clock now, and anyone that's done a championships knows that you've got 90 minutes to pick your number up. So I wasn't at the track, so I had to phone a friend to pick my number up for me. And I got to the EIS in Sheffield an hour before the heats of the 1500, strolling, still in my suit, still in my smart shoes. And someone says, heats have been cancelled. I was like, oh, this is brilliant. Absolutely love this. So I stroll back round to the warm-up area, and someone says, no, it's a straight final now. I was like, what do you mean it's a straight final? The women's has just been cancelled and they're going tomorrow. And the short story is, it's still a conspiracy theory of mine that they knew I was traveling back. And there was a certain culprit that I won't name names, that he was quite an infamous character at British Athletics at the time. But he'd heard that I was trying to do both. And it was almost a bit of, well, you can't mess around with these because, you know, obviously you thought it was going to be heats that might be cancelled. So we're going to make it a final. So I remember ranting and seeing Steve Cram and ranting that I can't believe it was a straight final. And I think he said something like, well, you just have to get on with it now. And I remember, and that was 40 minutes before. So I did a Superman change in the changing rooms, got into my running kit, went and did my warm up. The adrenaline now was going through my veins like you just wouldn't believe. And I stepped out into the track, and I actually finished second in the British Championships behind Michael East, who was going to be Olympic finalist later that year, made the team for the World Championships off the back of that. But really funnily, the interviews and the interest after for Mike was minimal. The next day in the Sunday Times on the back page, so I didn't make Athletics Weekly front cover, but back page of the Sunday Times was my travel journey with a map of where I'd been, what I'd been doing at certain times. This was before social media, so I can't imagine what it had been like if I'd have followed myself on Instagram doing those different things. And so ultimately, it was a good lesson that I sometimes give to my athletes or talk to people, that actually sometimes you can finish second in things, or actually the winner should have got far more attention in both. But if you've got a good story to tell, then that it can capture people's imaginations. And also, I had a great time doing it. I look back at it now, and I could have done one or the other, and it would have been good. I was lucky I didn't win the mile in New York, because I would have been drugs tested and wouldn't have missed the flight. So that's good I didn't win that, even though it's strange that I had the chance to win a world famous mile. I just look back now, and I've done some flights recently, or not that recently, but transatlantic ones, and I'm I can't run or I can't do much for 2-3 days after. So I don't know how I did either, looking back on it. So it's funny what you can do with adrenaline, I think.
Yeah, that's an incredible story. With the time difference between New York and the UK, how long did you actually have between races?
Yeah, so I think it was the equivalent of racing. I think it's something like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. So whilst my competitors for the British champs, you know, were lying in bed fast asleep, they'd probably been asleep for 2-3 hours. I was on the boards in Madison Square Garden on this 180 meter track that always felt like you were falling over. So I think it was 16 hours and 5,500 miles in that time from door to door. And as I said, you know, two big performances. Actually, I ran my indoor personal best the week after, ran 3:38 indoors the week after. So it just didn't impact me back then. And I feel lucky I had that opportunity. You know, having a brother that worked in British Airways was a golden ticket, because at one point I could fly anywhere in the world for tax. And most of the time you got a nice upgrade and got looked after. So I was very lucky. I could hop to New York as cheaply as I could, and National Express to Manchester. So is that
then one of the key reasons why you were racing so frequently abroad? Because say you were known for sort of being, obviously you earned the right to be in the races, but like you say, it's not that easy just to race in New York on a weekend.
Yeah, no, it was a lot to do with that. And also I had some amazing friends out there, and again, got to know people. And, you know, rather than, I probably should have been doing a post-race session on the track. I was in the local bar that backed onto the athletics track, meeting people, and they're friends for life. You know, I still talk to them every week, and you know, that there's still, you know, people that are in my life there. And there's people that I met in that bar that, you know, have gone on to be great coaches and beyond. And it's funny, it's like almost, again, just absorbing the journey you're on and meeting people and talking to people. And I was lucky to do that in different countries like Bermuda, in Hawaii, New York, you know, as I said, stay with my club there. So I just feel lucky that I, you know, kind of experience it. Some athletes now just have quite a sterile existence. And that's great. Don't get me wrong. I probably could have run a lot faster if I'd have been I don't want to say professional, because I was professional. But yeah, if I'd have done it slightly differently. But then I don't think I would have had the experiences, definitely not. And I wouldn't have met the people that helped me now. Yeah. Whereas there's a lot of people that had more talent, ran faster, but they've got no footing in the sport or friends beyond that, because they just didn't want to know. So that's that fine line between performance and enjoying the journey as well.
Yeah, quite right. James, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. We've got a few other things we wanted to talk about, but I think we can save them for another time.
Love it.
I think that's a great subject to close on. Could you just quickly, where can people see more about yourself, about your team, follow kind of the journey that you guys are on?
Yeah, so we're on social media, so at Team Fee. So that's on Instagram and Twitter.
My entire life.
Some people say T. It's the to most.
I think you get to decide. You get to tell me if I'm saying it wrong.
It's the thighs and the ties we don't like. So
T's acceptable, but
T's acceptable in any climate. Yeah. So if you say thigh and tie, I'm off.
sorry, I was interrupting you. Where can people see your team's
update? Yeah, so on Instagram, on Twitter, you can obviously follow some of the athletes that we have running around. And said, if you want to see, not quite yet because he's on a bit of a break, but obviously Jake's Strava, then look back on that and pick your jaw off the floor. And then we've got some exciting stuff coming up this summer as well, so that I'm looking forward to being involved with. So
anything in particular that sticks out for this
a certain sort of day camps, isn't it? So weekends that we're basically bringing running and the understanding about running to anyone that wants to learn a bit more. I know we talked about some different stories and different kind of understandings on, you know, what goes into the emotions of coaching, into the environment of coaching. But I think, yeah, we're looking at, you know, the information that's going to come up or come out, you know, from these camps is come and get involved with them and, you know, talk to other people. I mean, we learn often by talking to coaches presenting, but we also talk. I think it's great. You know, we've missed them with that interaction with other runners as well. And so it's a real opportunity to, you know, to talk to other runners. So look out for the Running Trips running camps for runners. I just think it's, you know, in this day and age where we can't travel abroad, so travel in the UK. We've got some in Loughborough, we've got some in Cardiff. So you also get to come down to my neck of the woods as well, and enjoy the Welsh weather and scenery. And I just think, yeah, just, you know, in this current climate where a lot of people maybe are looking for that next little jump, or that next little bit of insight into their own running, that bit of motivation, hopefully what is going to be, you know, a winter of running as well. We've got some in the summer, but going into the into October as well. So I just think that there's a timeline that might suit some for everyone. And yeah, and you get to come and pick my brains as well. So no questions are too big or too small.
Yeah, thanks, James. That's a really nice summary, because I think that kind of does sum up essentially what we're trying to do. Is that we're not trying to just say, right, come to these places and do some hard training and run in a cool place with a nice backdrop, which is also part of it.
Yeah,
come and learn from people who've got this experience and have got these different perspectives, and see if we can find ways that are going to help you become a better runner in the long term.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's it in a nutshell, isn't it? So, and just, as I said, and that interaction that I think people are just craved, just seeing people in real life and talking to real people in real life. I just think that's going to be a massive kind of, positive to it as well. So I'm looking forward to seeing it. You know, as I said about my coaching at the very beginning, actually helping people face to face, isn't that be a great thing?
Yes, exactly. James, thank you so much.
Brilliant.
I hope we can do this again at some point in the future. But yeah, thank you for
pleasure.
We will.
Thanks very much, James.
Gab, take care, guys. Bye bye.
Cheers. Bye. Mate.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Conversations About Running with Coach James T. James will be our head coach at Training Focus Camps this summer. We have dates available in Loughborough and Cardiff. So if you're a competitive runner of any level looking to improve their running, find out more at www.runningtrips.co.uk/Training Focus Camps. Our thanks go to Saucony, who will be supporting Training Focus Camps this summer. That's all from myself, Gavin Smith, and my co-host, Callum Jones. And we hope you join us again shortly for another episode of Conversations About Running.